Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, domestic violence is just one of the many problems of violent sports. We'll take a close look at American football and its discontents. Then, on the heels of the United Nations Climate Conference, we'll revisit the impacts and potential solutions to global warming. Domestic violence and sexual abuse may have tarnished American football, but the problem may be much deeper than the headlines suggest, according to our next guest. The American football system damages its players, the families, and communities. Steve Almond is with us. He's a journalist and author of three books, including his latest, Against Football, A Reluctant Manifesto. Welcome, Steve Almond. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Let's start with this brief and wildly subjective history of football. You said it really began more or less as a series of controlled riots. How did it become football?
Yeah, well, it became football. So it really was a hazing ritual. And this is going back to the 1850s, basically the middle of the 19th century. And it combined elements, gradually sort of appropriated elements from soccer, mostly from rugby. It was a very violent game, and there was no passing. It was kind of these masses of young players basically smashing into one another. And it really became so violent. In 1904, there were 18 prep school and college kids. There was no pro game at that time, so there were these prep school and college kids who were killed playing the game, and a whole bunch of others who were paralyzed or otherwise disfigured. And, you know, the various schools started to threaten to actually abolish football, and a number of them actually did. And Teddy Roosevelt, who was a big football player and supporter of football, he thought it was a manly game, of course, and he had a son at Harvard who had just gotten his nose broken. He called a bunch of school officials to the White House and said, look, you know, we want you to reform the game, but don't make it too ladylike, was what he said in essence. And in fact, he was suggesting that it was the school officials who really realized, or the people who were, you know, heads of the football teams, coaches and stuff, who realized we need to do something to reform the game to make it less violent. Otherwise, it's really, people aren't going to stand for it. There were editorials calling for its abolition all over the country. And so what they did is they basically created a neutral zone. They legalized the forward pass. They made a number of crucial innovations that basically gave the game suddenly had a Z-axis. You know, you could throw the ball, put more of an emphasis on speed and agility, and it spread the game out. It wasn't just these masses of guys running at one another. And it actually made the game far more dramatically interesting. That's the amazing thing about the history of football, is that it survived its savagery. And because of the reforms, the game became so much more suspenseful. It had a real much greater narrative sense. And it got more and more popular, to the point that a pro league started and it became a big business, essentially. But it's fascinating because it was sort of these incremental innovations. It wasn't just all at once it became the game we know now. It's been tinkered with over the years, largely in response to the fact that it was just so brutal and violent in its early days.
What's interesting to me to question why the U.S. really made the American version of football the big sport, sure, while in other countries, mostly we see what they call football, which is soccer. And then down here in the Southern Hemisphere, we have rugby as a very big sport. Why do you speculate that it became this sport?
That's a complicated question. I speculated about it, and a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me and thought about it a lot longer than I have offer some really smart speculation about it as well. And one of the things that you have to realize is, you know, America has this in its bloodstream, is the idea of the regeneration of the spirit through violence. You know, in the colonial days, certainly the frontier and the way in which essentially a genocide was what made Manifest Destiny possible, or was actually the direct result of Manifest Destiny. There's always been the idea that the way that American, and especially American masculinity, affirms itself in the world is through violence and aggression, controlled violence and aggression. So that's very much what football is about, as compared with sort of the pastoral nature of baseball. It's a collision sport. It is about putting your body and your will at risk against another man and seeing, you know, surviving a certain kind of danger and finding not only an appropriate but a heroic context for violence. That is, I think, just an American trait. I also think that the time that football came along was a fascinating time in American history, because it was on the heels of the Industrial Revolution, where people who had lived off the land and had been, especially the men, had been defined by very vigorous physical activity and the possibility of danger, carrying a rifle you know, making sure that you could survive in this kind of rugged wilderness or frontier. And in fact, suddenly these American men were in cities, in factories, in offices, and they were looking for a way to connect back to the sort of masculine ideals of their immediate forebears. And football offered them that. It was a spectacle that, again, was both incredibly narratively satisfying and suspenseful, competitive, which is another big part of the American experience, is that it's a hyper-competitive culture, great emphasis on winning and losing in a kind of public way. And people suffer and struggle with those things privately in the United States. But in fact, it's very gratifying for that reason to see it played out in a very public, overt way. So I think that had a lot to do with it. And I think that, you know, people being able to connect to a game that really was very much about an overt and exalted brand of masculinity at a time that men were feeling increasingly hemmed in and disconnected from that part of their identities. That was a big engine. And I think essentially that the game, once it became something that, once television came along, it's the perfect game for television because of its dramatic possibilities, because of the fact that the game itself is contained in a box. Unlike baseball, where you've got this giant field, most of the action in football is contained in a smaller area. And, you know, I think once the promoters of football realized that there was gold in them, there are tackles, they really quickly innovated the way that the game was presented to the public, the pageantry of it, the spectacle of it, the uniforms, the cheerleaders, the big stadium. You know, America's very good at presenting big public spectacles. This is kind of a ritualized, romanticized form of violence. It's a simulated form of combat, and we're good at that stuff. I don't know morally that that's a good thing to be good at, but we are very good at it.
And it was much faster than other sports at the time, such as baseball.
Oh, yeah. I mean, baseball was really, you know, I think the famous quote is baseball is what we were, football is what we are. You know, that there was something about the way in which the culture sped up after the Industrial Revolution. And you have such an increase in literally the way that people can move around. The mobility kind of goes crazy and everything is all about speed. The media becomes kind of, you know, dedicated to getting stories out quickly. And people themselves are able to move about the world and communicate much more quickly. And, of course, we're seeing that now. You know, we've only gotten faster and faster and faster. And I think football is one of those games that very much plugs into that. It, you know, soccer is an amazing game, but there isn't that much scoring and there isn't that much strategic density of strategy is not that great. You know, football really plugged into the way that capitalism, especially late model capitalism, but even the early forms of capitalism, was very much about sort of a managerial class, a very complicated perspective, making sure that a whole bunch of people could work together interdependently, like in an office or a corporation. It's really a very corporate kind of sport. It has moments of great beauty and improvisation, but if you've ever seen an NFL playbook, it's like, you know, thicker than a phone book. It's a giant, complicated document that has to sort of take into account a million different contingencies and possibilities and routes being run. So you have that incredible strategic density, which is why I think it's the secret vice of the intellectual. But at the same time, there are these moments of primal aggression and real unexpected beauty and liberation when the running back just makes just the right cut, bursts through the hole, heads for the end zone, you know, with nothing but grass between him and glory. These are the kind of things that football supplies that are much more visceral and satisfying, frankly, as a fan of the game than for, you know, baseball or basketball, where there's constantly scoring. The momentum swings very quickly. Just as a writer, as somebody who's interested in narrative, I find football so much more satisfying than other sports. It makes me wish I could watch it. You know, I'm no longer watching the game, but I still miss it.
Yes, you say you're actually against football.
Well, yeah, the name of the book is a little bit dopey, frankly. The name of the book, the name that I wanted was This Eager Violence of the Heart. And I wanted to call it a meditation or maybe even a lamentation, because that's what I think it is. It's, I get it that for commercial purposes, they wanted to say, oh, well, against football and, you know, kind of get people stirred up. But if you read the book, I'm more heartbroken than angry. It's more heartbreaking that there was this beautiful game that I played a little bit as a kid and enjoyed so much, has so much beauty to it, so intricate. There's the players themselves, I believe, are really valorous and heroic and, you know, incredibly disciplined. And at the same time, they have just physical gifts that the rest of us can only dream about. I mean, Americans also love to see greatness, and football is a way, athletics in general, but football in particular, is a way of seeing greatness as measured against real danger. These guys are always in danger. So I think, you know, there's a real sense, for me anyway, that I'm just more heartbroken that there's this incredibly huge corrupt industry that's grown up around the game.
And become more so. I thought it was really very interesting, too, how football was sort of a uniting subject between people who normally would never have anything in common, like President Nixon and Hunter S. Thompson.
Right. Yeah, its appeal is so broad that it really cuts across a lot of, but I think primarily for men, I'll say, it's this kind of lingua franca. I find that argument ultimately pretty sad in a way. It's true, but it's sad that we need such a savage game to feel that we can speak to people of a different socioeconomic status, different geographic region, different sensibility. Like the fact that the glue of American male culture is this profoundly violent game that's also this rapacious, greedy industry, to me is part of the heartbreaking aspect of football. But it's true also that, you know, it's something I can immediately kind of connect to another guy around. I will say that that connection is really a kind of vouchsafing of our masculinity, of our bona fides, of our heterosexuality. And that aspect too of it is also kind of creepy to me, that, you know, sports in general and football in particular is one way in which you sort of say, yeah, I'm a dude. Yep, that's right. I'm a dude. Yeah, there's no question. I like ladies and I'm a dude, you know. I think that's always an undercurrent, although we don't talk about that. That's partly what the whole language of sports is a way for men to be able to have discourse where otherwise they feel that just connecting with a man around something else, family or spirituality or whatever it is, would somehow make them suspect.
So here we have presidents on the left and the right. We have Eisenhower, we have the Kennedys, we have Nixon, and we have people like Abby Hoffman, we have the Black Panthers. They all have this common lingo, so to speak. It maybe is the common ground.
Okay, but what is the nature of the common ground? I mean, I hear this argument a lot, and that, you know, sort of, oh, it bonds people. Well, okay, so does tuberculosis, you know? What's the nature of the discourse that's going on around the game, and why is it necessary? You know, I have a neighbor who I love, but I do find it, and he's a great guy, but I do find it disheartening that we need a football game in order to spend time together. Do you know what I mean? Like, wait a second, why can't we just find comfort and succor in one another's company? Why can't we honestly talk about the stuff that we struggle with as parents and as, you know, husbands and so forth? I'm not saying that it isn't true that people bond over football, but given the fact that a third of the players end up with brain damage and that we as fans consuming the violence, you know, these guys sort of in their prime and their youth, ultimately down the road, they're going to wind up with serious cognitive ailments like dementia and Alzheimer's and ALS. There's something unwholesome about the fact that we need such a savage, violent game to connect with one another.
Well, let's talk about some of these brain injuries. You spent quite a bit of time in your book writing about this. You told stories, for example, this Dave Durson, who had a form of dementia,
right,
shot himself, and then asked to have his brain used for research.
Right.
Tell us this story and help us understand what the sort of common ailment here is.
It's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's basically a form of dementia that was one time was called, I think, dementia pugilistica. It was associated with boxing, but it's basically a deterioration of the brain from repeated hits. The brain is a soft organ inside a hard shell. When the brain is knocked around, when you run into somebody, when you collide with somebody, that brain smashes up against the inside wall of the skull, and it causes little damage to the brain. This happens to football players because it's a collision sport. Hundreds and thousands of times, and even in a particular season, it happens in practice, it happens in the games, and everybody focuses on concussions, big brain traumas where, you know, somebody will pass out, be wobbly afterwards, have headaches, sensitivity to light. You can tell that there's been a major trauma to the brain, but the medical research has really caught up with football and sports in general, and what we now know is that it's the accretion of subconcussive hits that can lead to this deterioration of the brain. So those happen all the time, and it's not like somebody's being led off the field and you realize they're injured. It's an invisible form of injury that builds up over time, and it's actually terrifying for players because, you know, there's a study that was done in Purdue, at Purdue University, that I talk about in the book, where they looked at the effect of concussions, or they're trying to look at the effect of concussions on high school players. So they put monitors in a couple dozen players' helmets, and they wanted to see what the brain activity was for the kids with concussions, and then they had a control group of kids who'd never had concussions. The problem is that the kids in the control group were showing diminished brain function as well. And over the course of one season, their brain function for some of these kids had actually disappeared in one of their frontal lobes. That's how much their brain activity had diminished. That's a high school kid who's never been diagnosed with a concussion, who has no function in one of their frontal lobes. That should be deeply terrifying to any parent, but more than that, to anybody who's a fan of football, that the game is inherently that violent. And I know people talk about, well, what about better equipment and changing the rules? It's like, well, look, unless it becomes fundamentally a different game, not the violent game that we so enjoy consuming with the parabolic mics on the sidelines picking up every decibel of every bone-crunching hit and the replays of the most violent sequences broadcast over and over again, unless we, the fans, decide that that brutality is too much, it's going to stay in the game. And no matter what they do to tweak the rules, there are going to be these subconcussive hits. And because the players are bigger and stronger and faster than ever, because of the physics of it, mass times acceleration equals force, they're going to continue to do damage. The NFL just admitted in federal court they anticipate 30% of their former players are going to wind up with brain damage at a significantly younger age than the rest of the population. That's really not morally, as a society, I don't think that's tenable. I don't think we would accept that in any other realm of the culture. And I think legally and financially, it's hard to have a business model where a third of your employees, you just admit up front, are going to get brain damage.
Let me just remind listeners that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Steve Almond about his new book, Against Football. You also mentioned that their lives are actually shortened, maybe by 20 years.
Well, I have to be honest, it's not clear what the mortality figures are. It's just absolutely not clear. There's one study the NFL likes to cite that shows football players have longer lives. Other researchers who are not affiliated with the NFL suggest that it's actually shortening the athletes' lives. Nobody knows. Until a decent longitudinal study is done, nobody can say with any assurance. What we can say is that the quality of their life is very likely to be diminished. And it's not just because of brain injuries. These guys are absolutely beaten up. Nobody who's a fan, I don't think, realizes how beat up a football player is, how profoundly violent the game is. You know, we watch from the comfort of our couches. The players have helmets on and uniforms. We do not understand exactly the kind of pain and brutality of guys that big and fast slamming into one another with helmets on. It's just impossible to convey. You would literally need to have some kind of chair that, you know, was like the real NFL experience, and it took the fan and basically flung him onto the floor at full force with like the force of a 300-pound lineman. Then we could begin to understand how beat up these guys are in a day-in, day-out way. But if you talk to any former player at the highest levels, college or pro, or you read, for instance, the memoirs of former players, they're all about how beat up their bodies are. Not to mention that psychologically and emotionally, it's really tough when your place of work is a place where you could get booed by 50,000 people or excoriated by an entire community if you drop the big pass or, you know, somehow fail to perform or get injured and don't come back early enough. So there's all this pressure that's on these players physically, psychologically, and so forth. And, you know, we're seeing right now that players' aggression on the field is also being expressed off the field. And that shouldn't come as any shock to us.
And it shouldn't come as a shock to us because?
Because they are trained from the time they're 5 years old to suppress their empathy and to express their aggression on the field. That is exactly how you become a great football player, is you simply say, I'm going to tackle this guy and make sure he doesn't get up again, or I'm going to run over him if I need to. That's how you play football. And it's really hard to say to somebody after 20 years of indoctrinating him in a thought system that says, in order to be effective in the world, I've got to suppress my empathy and express my aggression. Hey, but that's really only on the field. The moment you step over that chalk line, you know, past the cheerleaders, who are the designated symbols of femininity in this world, basically sexual ornaments, once you're off that field, you have to be a gentleman role model. I just don't think that's the way that people function.
It it's a little bit like soldiers, isn't it? Where they get trained to essentially be aggressive, and then they have to go home and try to be gentle with their families?
Correct. I wouldn't say it's a little like soldiers. I say it's a lot like soldiers. I mean, it's a simulated form of combat. And by the way, this is, to me, kind of the heartbreaking aspect of stories in which people are jumping on athletes, you know, for sins off the field. Yes, they should be held accountable. Yes, the legal system should hold them accountable, even if they're rich, famous athletes. They shouldn't be exempt. But we should understand that it is our consumption of the violence as fans that causes them to, in stressful situations, when they make impulsive decisions, the direction that their mind and body goes towards is fight. They don't think flight, they think fight. And, you know, we're a part of that system.
And speaking of the system, one of the pieces of the system is the coach. You described a story in which a coach essentially manipulated a player. It was Ted Johnson, who was supposed to, because he'd had a concussion, be given the jersey that said no hard contact. What happened in that story, and how frequently does this happen?
What happened is that Johnson knew he was hurt and didn't want to have a full contact jersey on. He went to a trainer when he found it in his locker and said, hey, I need a red jersey, minimal contact jersey, because I have a concussion. I'm still recovering. And he found the trainer said, oh, yeah, it's a mistake. You're not cleared for contact. So Johnson puts on the red jersey. Out on the practice field, as they're preparing for a contact drill, an assistant trainer brings him a blue jersey, a contact jersey, and says, Coach Belichick had directed him to do so. Johnson is very angry about this, but he puts the jersey on anyway. And the reason he does that is because he's trying to keep his job, he's trying to keep his sense of pride, and this game is all about the highest accolade that we give to a player in football is that they play hurt, that they're willing to sacrifice. It's almost a Christian idea, you know, that the sort of the ravaged body is the signifier of devotion to the ultimate cause, which in this case is, you know, sort of the victory, the team's triumph. So players have this very, I would say, almost masochistic attitude, but they would call it self-sacrificing attitude, where they play hurt all the time. They get shot up with painkillers. They do what they have to do to get back on the field. And Ted Johnson is sitting there saying, I need Bill Belichick, the coach, to understand that I'm a tough guy and I'm not going to fight this. He put it like this, they weren't going to beat me. That's how Johnson thought of it. And in fact, what Belichick had done had gotten Johnson to beat himself. And Johnson suffered a concussion shortly after this episode and has had struggled with cognitive problems, you know, really ever since. The truth of the matter is that's Bill Belichick being a good coach. The incentives are for him to get the quote-unquote most out of his players, and that means getting them to look past their own short and long-term health considerations because they can help the team.
The coaches are part of the system. The fans are a big part of the system. We haven't talked that much yet about the big business aspect of this system. We sort of briefly touched on the NFL itself, but we've got marketers, we've got PR people, we've got lobbyists. How would you describe this?
Well, it's basically a cartel. I mean, it's a legal monopoly. The NFL is tax exempt. Of course, the NCAA is a whole separate entity. They're a huge industry, and they've got a great business model because they've got free labor. You know, none of these college players get paid anything. They get a scholarship to the school, but there's not much real concern about their academic standing. The concern is that they're eligible on game day, at least at the big programs. And that's, I don't think anybody would deny that. That's just the reality. But at the pro level, so the NCAA, in other words, I want to say extort, because, you know, in essence, we consent to it. The public consents to it. But 70% of the funding for stadiums, football stadiums around the country, pro football stadiums, is public money. Money that might be spent on schools or law enforcement or infrastructure or economic opportunity is spent building these huge stadiums. And the public does not see, for their tax dollars, does not see a return of 70% or 50% or 20%. They see a negligible return on that. The sports economists will say, who've really looked at the issue, essentially say, look, you know, NFL teams do create a lot of entertainment, but those entertainment dollars would be spent in other ways if there was no NFL team, and in ways that would probably be better for the local economy, since the NFL really only has about 8 or 10 games a year, and most of the jobs that are provided on game day are low-wage, temporary jobs. It's the circus approach to economic development. So that's what's happening in a macro way, and it means that we need to stop thinking about football as just something that the fans have an interest in. Everybody has an interest in it because it is a huge billion-dollar industry. And actually, Roger Goodell wants it to be, if he sticks around, or his successor will want it to be even bigger. And that's going to mean more invisible costs for products where the advertisers have to pay a lot to advertise. The networks and the cable packages that we buy are going to get more and more expensive. There are these sort of invisible costs that are passed on to all of us that we don't associate with football, but that are basically the profits are going into the pockets of very, very wealthy men. They really operate in a risk-free business environment. I mean, it's pretty galling when you think about the idea that this industry that generates $10 billion a year in revenues is tax-exempt.
We've also got a lot of racial issues caught up in this.
There's a bunch of excuses, kind of rationalizations that football fans carry around. And I know this because I was a football fan and still am, I guess, in the sense that I still love the game. I just don't consume it anymore. But, you know, you carry around a little suitcase full of rationalizations. The first one is, oh, the players are adults. They're, you know, they make this decision. They have free will. They earn a lot of money to play the game. And so it's that the moral decision, that's their responsibility. But in fact, their salaries, all the inducements for them to play, come from our devotion as fans. Without us, actually, there is no NFL. We're ultimately the people who created the football industrial complex. And so that's what my book is trying to get people to realize is, hey, we the fans are also the sponsors. Another line that people use all the time is that football is the only way out for a certain kind of kid. And in the coded language that we tend to use in the United States, what we really mean is a poor kid, a kid from an economically vulnerable neighborhood, and usually a kid of color. You know, two-thirds of the NFL are African Americans. And the truth of the matter is that that is an absurd and degrading idea of economic opportunity. That if you get, we're saying essentially to young kids of whatever color, but most of them happen to be African American, if you get, here's how you can succeed. We're not going to give you a good school or good teachers or, you know, support for your working parent or guardian. But what we're going to do is if you get really good at a super savage game, we are going to give you a 1 out of 500 possibility that you're going to make a whole bunch of money. And if 1 out of 500 high school seniors who play football wind up actually in the NFL, and they end up in the NFL for 3.5 to 4 years, and they're usually broke, you know, within several years of leaving the league. So it's really a lotto ticket mentality. It's a distraction from the fact that it's not okay for 1 out of 500 kids to succeed and find economic salvation. We should be worried about the other 499 who aren't great football players.
Tying back to your earlier point, which is so many of them end up with brain damage, brain injuries.
You know, their health is compromised. And more than that, there's no interest taken in the content of their character, in their intellectual development, in their moral development. They're really trained, they're segregated and trained from a very early age to be good at one very limited thing. And it's an amazing thing to be good at. You know, to be a professional athlete, I'm not trying to take anything away from how hard that is and, you know, how courageous the guys are, but it doesn't really prepare them for the totality of what life might bring them. It really is they lead a profoundly segregated life.
Steve Almond, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Steve Almond is a journalist and author of 3 books, including his latest, Against Football, A Reluctant Manifesto. When we come back, solutions to the sustainability crisis. Stay tuned. Hello, and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armodian. The world is experiencing some of the most catastrophic weather conditions, floods, lethal heat waves, fires, and droughts. Climate scientists say these may occur with more regularity. With melting ice sheets, sea levels are rising and coasts are retreating. Some historians and political scientists warn that the resulting scarcities of resources, such as drinkable water and food, could lead to more violent conflicts. We've assembled three scholars to discuss solutions to the climate change problem. Mark Jacobson is professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program. He develops computer models to study the effects of energy technologies and their emissions on climate and air pollution. William Mumma is with us. He is professor of international environmental policy and director of Fletcher's Center for International Environment and Resource Policy at Tufts University. He is a lead author of five intergovernmental panels on climate change reports, most recently coordinating lead author of the newest report on the role of renewable energy in addressing climate change. Ravi Rajan is professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he is the author of Modernizing Nature, Forestry in Imperial Eco-Development, 1800 to 1950. Ravi Rajan, let's have you start and walk us through your work in terms of sustainability issues and how they have affected human rights, poverty, these kinds of socio-political issues.
Sustainability traditionally has often been talked about in respect to the relationship between us as humanity and the rest of nature. And we have done, there's been a pretty fairly long and concerted discussion about the concept of sustainability. One can argue going back at least to the 18th century when systems and regimes of resource management like forestry and irrigation and so on were first established. And I've written quite a bit about that. Obviously, in the modern sense, sustainability refers to the relationship between biocapacity of the planet, if you will, and our ability to mobilize resources to live within our biological or biotic means, if you will. But there's another dimension to this sustainability debate, which has to do with human rights. And that has to do with the fact that in the course of development over the past 300 years or so, three particular things have happened. One of them is that the inequity in the way in which the mobilization of resources has benefited people that it is meant to benefit. So the first problem is what I call the problem of sustenance, or in other words, the problem of the absence of good or sustaining environments, or in other words, for various reasons, someone or the other, some group, country, entity has grabbed some of the most productive resource frontiers, be they forests, be they water, be they productive agricultural lands, etc. The second is the presence of bad environments, pollution being one, the presence of disasters, extremely toxic environments to live and work in, etc. This is the problem of what I call security. And lastly, I think there is what I call the problem of suffrage. Suffrage has often been considered to be about the ability to vote. But in reality, it's, as far as I'm concerned, for millions upon millions of people in the world, suffrage is really about having a say in the quality of the environment they live in. And virtually no political environment, one can argue, in the world fundamentally addresses environmental suffrage in this particular way. So if you ask me what sustainability's broader problem is, while I would concur that it has to do, certainly the starting point, has to do with humanity and its relationship with the rest of nature, I would simultaneously say that it is equally about sustenance, security, and suffrage.
Ravi Rajan, many scholars are finding that climate change is thought to be exacerbating these issues and even exacerbating the greater security issues, such as physical violence that it may provoke.
Yeah, this is, I think, I would argue, an absolute verity. There is this point for all the attempts to manufacturing dissent in this context. I think pretty much all of us in the scientific community are agreed that climate change does represent arguably one of the greatest threats that humanity at large has set. Of course, we've all read about the big macro trends about the state of the planet in relation to climate change. But I think where the rubber meets the road, the real conflicts are already beginning to occur. And they concern primarily, effectively, minor changes in climate change that affect things like river courses, the ebbs and flows of rainfall, the retreatment of vegetation, and so forth. And what this really does is it directly impacts on the economic viability of millions of people. And one of the biggest challenges, of course, even whilst I think we try and grapple with the sorts of responses that we as a planet need to make and try and get corral nation states and companies into treaties that are binding, is also to understand how we adapt at the micro level to these changes. It's something that's, I think, relatively less talked about, although in the scientific community, it is very much a significant question. How do we adapt to what is clearly a set of trends that affect the viability and livelihoods of people?
Well, that's a perfect place to bring William Mumma in. Please, William Mumma, respond to this. And also this point that Ravi Rajan is making about securing global agreements with regards to sustainability and climate change.
The points that Ravi has made are very pertinent. And the thing to remember is that the purpose of development is to improve the well-being of people. And unfortunately, we tended to focus mostly on only one component of what is known as sustainable development, which is the economic component. And in doing so, we've chosen ways of development which actually are degrading the environment, including the dramatic changes that we're seeing to the climate system. And the other component is the social development component, which Ravi works very much in. And that has been largely ignored in the last 20 years since sustainable development was agreed to as the framework that governments would use. And governments had a very hard time addressing climate change in particular, because if you think about it, it's all about telling people what they cannot do. And when you listen to the diplomats, they talk about burden sharing. Anything they're going to do is burden sharing. As I said in a recent paper, imagine a diplomat coming home and telling your fellow countrymen that the burden that you've brought them to share, because it's all viewed as things that we have to stop doing. And indeed, we do have to stop putting these gases in the atmosphere and releasing black carbon. But there is nothing in any national interest other than saving the climate, which doesn't seem to be in any national interest, unfortunately, of addressing the pollution side. It's a pollution control attempt treaty that we've been attempting to negotiate. And what we really need is a sustainable development treaty. And some things are moving in this direction. Some of the work that Mark Jacobson has done showing the possibilities of renewable energy and low-carbon energy in particular have led to programs, the Energy for All program, which unfortunately is voluntary and put in terms of things we ought to do. But only if we move in those directions are we going to get something that's in the interest of all the parties, so that we can begin to really address climate change from a sustainable development perspective rather than a pollution control perspective.
I'm going to want to go back to that a bit, but since you have cued Mark Jacobson, it's the perfect time to bring him in. Mark Jacobson, great to have you back with us again. You and your co-authors have been studying how to take the entire planet to renewable energy, and you've argued that it's completely feasible to do this through wind, mostly, and solar water. So let's start with an overview in this.
Sure. Well, first, we think it's technically feasible to repower the world. And when I say technically, in terms of the resources, in terms of materials, in terms of even costs, whether it happens or not will depend a lot on politics and whether people really want to do it and try to change the subsidy system. But in terms of looking at the big picture, right now, if we look at the end use power demand worldwide, it's about 12.5 terawatts. That number might not mean anything, but just as a relative number, let's say 12.5 terawatts. In 2030, with business as usual, if population goes up and we keep using more energy, it's estimated to be about 17 terawatts. It turns out if we convert the entire energy infrastructure for all purposes, that's electricity, for heating and cooling, for transportation, and for industrial processes, if we convert it to electricity and electricity-derived hydrogen, so convert all, for example, combustion vehicles to electric vehicles or some hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, if we convert any combustion process to an electric process, we go down, the total power demand goes down by about 32% worldwide to 11.5 terawatts. In fact, in the United States, it would go down by 37% just because of the efficiency of electricity. So we looked at, to get that 11.5 terawatts, what do you need and what kind of resources do you need? And so we figured that we could do it with about 50% wind, 40% solar, and 10% all the other clean renewables. And we looked at how many devices you would need and how much land you would need for this. And these are not large numbers when you consider this magnitude of what we're trying to do. For example, it's about 4 million 5-megawatt wind turbines to do 50% of the world. And in World War II, the world produced about 800,000 airplanes in 4 or 5 years. So 4 million wind turbines, it's not really out of our reach. But to get that, to actually do that, it takes a lot of political willpower. And there's so many competing interests in the natural gas, because natural gas prices are low now, and also still with coal in many countries, and oil is not going away very quickly. So I think that's the big challenge, is how to convince people to, even if they're the same price, say wind, and which is, I mean, wind is the second largest new source of electric power in the U.S. on average for the last 5 years. And this last year, wind plus solar were 68% of all of Europe's new electric power. But there's still a lot of new natural gas and coal going in. And so how do you get the wind and solar more preference than these other technologies to really change the entire energy infrastructure? And that's the big challenge.
Ravi Rajan, let's bring you back in for a moment. One of the issues that I think might come up with regards to the renewable project, if we were to go forward with Mark Jacobson's ideas and research, one of the issues is reducing pollution, of course. But on the other hand, there's also the materials issue. Can you speak to this in terms of social and political justice and how that is affected?
Everything, every public policy or allocation question has costs and benefits. And I think overall, the big question that one's going to ask is trade-off between persisting with this high fossil fuel intensive pathway as opposed to alternatives. So to imagine that there's going to be no conflict nowhere is fantasy land. One would imagine, and I haven't actually crunched all the numbers because this isn't exactly my particular field, but one would imagine very clearly that the benefits of what is being proposed here in terms of transitioning to a renewable energy economy can be spectacularly good. There are large swaths of the planet that have absolutely no access to fossil fuels. And one can imagine that there is a brewing volcano, mix these metaphors up, in the sort of largely expanding portions of Asia in particular, with the large economies there trying to line up the existing fossil fuel resources. Clearly, if it is possible to use, harness renewable sources of energy a lot in the scale that's being proposed here, I cannot see anything but a win-win, to be brutally honest. And because energy is crucial, and we've got to find some way of harnessing it.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about potential solutions for the climate change crisis. William Uma, let's bring you in here.
I knew there was something to be concerned about when the headliner on the official Rio summit was extolling 700 voluntary agreements. That was an indication that maybe we didn't have any other kind of agreements to talk about. There's nothing wrong with voluntary agreements, except that, you know, you're never sure whether they're going to get put in place or not. But there's actually was far more action outside of what governments were doing than there was inside what governments were doing. And that's where it has to be done in any case. But without overall policy directions, it's very, very difficult to get everybody moving in the same direction, get everybody on the same page, so to speak. It's not just that the fossil fuels are, well, we usually talk about how coal is so cheap, but coal is not cheap because basically we're paying huge costs for the use of coal. Economies, particularly in developing countries, are just having their economies devastated by having to pay for oil with hard currency, and the price of that keeps fluctuating upward and downward and very high, and is devastating these economies. And none of that is taken into account when we say that these fuels are cheap. On top of this, the industries themselves have been making a mighty effort to sow a lot of disinformation about climate change, making it very difficult to get any kind of a political agreement. And finally, one of the wonderful things about the proposal that Mark and his co-workers have made and others have made similar sorts of things is that, you know, renewable energies are, solar and wind, for example, are brought to you for free. And the scale of them is huge. There's 8,000 times as much solar energy hitting the earth as we use in commercial energy every year. There's perhaps 12 times as much wind energy that can be harnessed on the earth compared to what we use. And every place in the world has access to some flow, some natural energy flow that can fuel their economies. And that would greatly reduce conflict and go a long way towards alleviating poverty in the world. And yet, government after government is defending the status quo, as one diplomat said, long after the quo has lost its status. So it's troubling, and it's a challenge for us. And we need to figure out how to make this be seen as opportunities rather than as a problem.
William Mumo, you've written about the limitations of international law, and partly because of how it privileges economic interests. Can you talk about this system as you've seen it and how it is hindering our forward motion?
Yes. What has happened, and this happens periodically, and it's to greater or lesser extent, that the economic interests tend to dominate policy decisions. And when you have extremely large economic interests, like some of the energy companies now, like the banks now, they're able to dictate policies which basically support them rather than address the problems of society. And so it's interesting. If you look at the United States, we have very little policy at the top. That is, there's very little national policy. And yet, at the state level, if you look at what California is doing with its implementation of AB 32, which would basically reduce carbon emissions by 80% by 2050, this is far ahead of what any government in the world is doing. I just happened to see something the other day. When I put solar panels on my house in 2006, there were so few being installed at that time in Massachusetts, but there's over something like 30 times that number being installed in 2012. That's a relatively short time to see that kind of an increase. So there's action at the local level. There's action at the city level, at the regional level, at the provincial and state level, because you do not have to balance at that level. I mean, there is no oil industry in Massachusetts. There is no coal industry in Massachusetts. So we can set policies that don't simply reinforce coal and oil. And there is still a role for international agreements. The fact that we have a climate treaty has brought to the attention of the world that all the governments agree this is a problem. And interestingly enough, even when the United States pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol, this unleashed a huge amount of mayors for climate change in the United States. And these are in politically red states and blue states. It's quite amazing. There are over 1,000 cities that mayors have made commitments to do something about climate change. So we need these treaties as kind of a statement that this is the direction we need to go, but we can't see them as the instruments for solving the problem. That's got to be done nationally, subnationally, locally, outside of government, private sector, NGOs, universities, the press, the media, everything.
Several directions we can go with that last bit that you said, but first let's go back to Mark Jacobson and talk about cost. You've done kind of an overview of how much it would cost. I'd like you to break that down a little bit in comparison to other energy uses that we have now, or energy sources. But then I wonder, because William just talked about industry, for example, if it might be possible to break out the costs for some of these big energy companies to move long-term into these renewable energies, and if that might be a motivational factor.
Yes. Well, let me start by touching on a point that you made earlier, which was renewable energies like solar and wind, they're very capital intensive, but they have zero fuel costs. So there's an upfront cost that's somewhat higher than traditional fuels, but they have zero fuel costs. So when you look at the what's called the amortized cost, or the cost for the electricity cost per kilowatt hour generated, for wind and hydroelectric and geothermal, they're very similar costs right now, when I say wind, onshore wind, to traditional coal and gas, although gas prices have dropped in the last couple of years. So those are very competitive. But the point, that the reason that's important that there's no fuel cost for these renewables, is that fossil fuels, their price fluctuates. And so you're subject to this price volatility and booms and busts and economic upturns and downturns. And these can be severe, especially as you go on and the fossil fuels become more scarce, the prices are only going to rise. Whereas for infinity time, effectively, for infinite time, renewable energies like wind and solar in particular, they'll have no fuel cost at all. And so you can have more price stability and social stability and economic stability in the long run with these technologies. But in terms of the kind of costs, these costs per unit energy generated, solar has been traditionally more expensive than the others, but the price has dropped significantly in the last few years. And so you see this massive growth, as was previously mentioned, in solar. And so that's becoming more competitive. Then there are different types of solar. There's solar thermal, which is hot water heating on your roof. There's photovoltaics for electric power. There's what's called concentrated solar power, where you focus light from the sun onto mirrors that go to a central tower receiver and heat a fluid, and that eventually runs a turbine. But the nice thing about that is you can actually store electricity at night, and so you have storage in concentrated solar. In fact, there's a plant in Spain that produces the electric power from the solar for 24 hours straight, and that allows you to manage the grid a lot easier and match the supply with demand, which is the traditional complaint about wind and solar, that they're two variables, that you can't control the wind and the sun, and as a result, you can't match the power demand with the supply, but you can with these storage devices. So the costs of some technologies are already competitive, others are coming down. We don't think this is an issue. But the one more point I want to make about this is that these externality costs or health costs that have also been mentioned today, I mean, these are significant. We just did an analysis for New York State and found that the mortality due to air pollution in the state, which is around 4,000 deaths per year, and in the U.S. it's about 50 to 100,000. Worldwide, there are about 2.5 to 3 million people die a year from air pollution. But in New York State alone, that mortality plus the morbidity associated with it, it costs the state about 3% of its gross domestic product. And in fact, we calculated that with that cost, you can actually pay for an entire clean renewable energy infrastructure just from the cost savings alone from the mortality morbidity cost in about 17 years. And this is an amazing statistic, how significant, how large these costs are that are being sent to the taxpayers and to the insurance ratepayers. I mean, our insurance costs are higher because of these health costs. Our taxes are higher because of them. And so not only we're subsidizing these industries in two ways, not only do they get direct subsidies, but they don't have to pay for their health costs they're incurring to society. So instead of a free market economy, it's more like a freeloading market economy in the case of these subsidies.
Well, I think there's one last point that I'd like to get to, which both of you are illuminating in different ways. Mark Jacobson, by all this amazing information. William Mumma, also, you mentioned the media directly. This is an area that Ravi Rajan also studies. Ravi Rajan, you have found that media actually confuses these issues. How would you say media is falling down on the job, and how could it or they actually serve society better with this matter?
Yeah, well, this is something that has been studied quite a bit. For example, my colleague Max Boykoff recently published a book exactly on this at Colorado. And the fundamental, there are many issues to it, of course, one of which is the fact that the media is not really a monolithic entity. It's got in it people, groups, and interests that are funded to produce or push one or another argument. There are also some internal constraints, such as the need to frame issues in binary oppositions, to create controversies of multiple perspectives, even when there might not be any, and so forth. Clearly, what we do have with media, of course, is a consolidation of power in the hands of a very few media outlets. But I think these are things that we do know. But I think I'd like to sort of look at this positively as well, in the fact that we now do have the means to at least technologically create a context or an environment in which perhaps better communication could be pushed out. So that, as far as I see it, one of the challenges that we have as an academic or a scientific community is in some respects to harness the emerging of web-based communication technologies, which clearly are going to be the future ways in which people are going to consume news, and try and create the sorts of you know, the communicative strategies that push out more signals that are actually have some verisimilitude as against all the noise that's been perpetrated in this area. It's certainly a very intractable, difficult question, given the funding structures that affect the media.
I would just say, I think the hopeful note is that the work of Mark Jacobs and others has demonstrated renewable energy is a viable option, but it's not just that it's renewable. It is low in carbon, it's low in pollution, it's low in causing conflicts among nations, and it's hugely abundant, and it has these economic advantages, as Marx pointed out, of fixed cost of the fuel, and you know when you build it what the cost is, so you know what the cost of the energy is going to be over time. And I think it really does show that there is a huge economic opportunity here for companies to get into this business and make a change. And I think what we'll see is that as more and more work is done at the state and city and local level, eventually national governments will come around. I mean, the Europeans, Germany, other countries are really doing this right now and having spectacularly good success at it. So it's not something that is theoretical anymore. It's something that is real, and it does provide the opportunity for people to improve their lives and have truly sustainable development.
I think that is the perfect place to end. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Mark Jacobson is Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford University and Director of the Atmosphere Energy Program. He develops computer models to study the effects of energy technologies and their emissions on climate and air pollution. William Mumma is with us. He is Professor of International Environmental Policy and Director of Fletcher's Center for International Environment and Resource Policy at Tufts University. He is a lead author of 5 intergovernmental panels on climate change reports, most recently coordinating lead author of the newest report on the role of renewable energy in addressing climate change. Ravi Rajan is Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he is the author of Modernizing Nature, Forestry in Imperial Eco-Development, 1800 to 1950. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Cuauhtemoc Gailaman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.